Everybody, this is Hunt Tooley, and this is the Ludwig von Mises course on World War I. As you can see from the slides there, we are ready to roll. It's 7:15, and we can start now. I realized I had put on a shirt that is a little too busy for my camera, so I'm getting a lot of wavy, crinkly thing, so I just rushed and put on my jacket to kind of knock some of that glare out, so I'll think about that next time and just wear a solid shirt. So if this evening we're at the halfway point for our course, or when we finish, we will be halfway done. And I think we're on track and doing well. I have sent out those questions for the first week. I'll send out a question for tomorrow's for the second week's second essay and so forth as we go, and so I'll get those out. Haven't received too many back yet, but and some have had a few problems getting them on there, but those have emailed me, so I have received a few, and I'll work over those in the next couple of days. So welcome to tonight's version of the course, and let's start right in. We did a kind of introduction and a kind of overview of causes and preludes to the war in the first episode. And in the second class, we talked about the Battle of the Frontiers and crossing some frontiers of several different kinds. Even more crossing of frontiers, conceptual, political, and so forth. In the third installment, from stalemate to stalemate last time. And this time our theme is an imperial war, empires and their enemies. So, and just looking down, we take this sort of stepwise, as the Germans say, Stufenweise. And we have next time the American entry and the two Russian revolutions. That's a very special kind of series of events in the war. Then in 6, we study war finance, war control, and then we talk a lot more about the battlefield, but also home front connections and the effects of these titanic wars. That's a line from Wilfred Owen, the British war poet. And then we talk about the peace and some other kinds of conclusions and results in the and costs in the last of the last of the series. So let's plunge right in and go to the Imperial War, Empires and Their Enemies. I'd like to break this lecture tonight into three chunks. It goes like this. At first we're going to talk not so much about empire, but about 1916 and a kind of dynamic of it. I'm not going to treat this in a sort of yearly fashion as I've featured in the last two lectures, because we'll come back and talk about 1916 in a lot of different ways. But I do want to make a special point about 1916 and a narrative of the war. And it's not just a way to remember the war, but also a way to analyze it from the standpoint of the ways that we want to look at it. So there's a very special kind of way that we want to look at this, and we're going to talk about that. Then we'll talk in general about empires at war and what I mean by that, and then we'll do some imperial case studies, and then we'll be done. So let's plunge in. I'd like to characterize 1916 as a year in which these great powers and small powers, baffled by the inability to break through the stalemate, whether it was just the stalemate of the Western Front, or the stalemate on the high seas, or the stalemate in the Balkans, or on the Eastern Front, or wherever, but baffled by their inability to use conventional, customary means to break through, then commanders, politicians, statesmen, people on the home front began to think more about unconventional, sometimes unthought of ways to break through. And we eventually moved from, in this year, I think, from breakthrough to an almost demographic, an almost disembodied way of looking at the war. And my argument's going to be that this demographic way of thinking about the battlefronts and about the home fronts as well was a product of great brutality, as great a brutality as the horrific war that resulted on the battlefronts themselves. So there were attempts to smash through this impasse, attempts to get through to the green fields beyond, but with the new techniques developed, tanks made their appearance in 1916, there are new techniques for all the established weapons, all of that tassel of weapons that we looked at last week, the flamethrowers, the grenade launchers, the poison gas, all of these things are combined into the beginnings of a new system of warfare that really has a kind of demographic edge to it. So 1916 is a time of big, huge battles using new techniques. Let's take the first one of several. And we won't cover all the battles of the war and all the military fronts, but I'm going to talk about the big, huge Armageddon-like battles that were thought up. If you take a look at this map on your screen, and I will try to remember to push. There we go. To push the arrow. If you take a look down here, remember there's a kind of S shape to the western front. We're going to be on the western front here for a few minutes. It moves its way on down all the way to the Swiss border way down there, but a little ways off the page. But up here, right at the big curve of the Western Front, that curve is actually curving around the fortified city of Verdun. It's got forts all around it. It was fortified from the days of Louis XIV, and then those forts were kept up. If you take a look at this aerial view of one of the forts around Verdun during the war, you see what I mean. These were huge, mostly underground complexes made in the most modern, with the most modern technologies. They were made of mortar, not stone, that was to absorb impact. They were made with artillery rigs that would raise the artillery piece up and to fire, and then the thing would disappear, and a couple would come back down on the top. Very, very sophisticated. In inside could the fort wasn't somehow taken or destroyed. They could live there for days and days and months with the supplies underground. And so these were huge forts in the city. And the Germans chose precisely this spot to attack. The general was Falkenhayn. He had replaced Moltke after Moltke's nervous breakdown. And General Falkenhayn, you'll see the spelling in a few minutes, decided that he would attack at precisely this tough point in the French line. And he partly wanted to attack, he said, because if he did that, he could bleed France white. Because there at Verdun, the French would fight. They wouldn't give up Verdun without a fight. There had been times, to tell you the truth, in the early stages of the war, when the French withdrawals had foiled German plans. They needed an anvil to hammer the French on, and the French tended to withdraw and use the... I mean, I'm not a military person, but it seems quite correct if it foiled the Germans' assault to use the space to absorb that impact and not just stay in place and fight for every foot. Well, the Falkenhayn thought that that he could bleed France white because they would fight for Verdun, and so in February 1916, he launched an all-out attack. And the method was attack, shell the French like crazy, attack again, and just keep doing that. What happened at Verdun was this. The French took this as an absolute disaster. It was an attack that they hadn't expected. It was a marshaling of explosive force and a troop force that they were totally unfamiliar with. It was more or less the biggest attack of the war up to that point, and the French were pretty stunned. They held on to the forts, but just barely. Therefore, the French high command sent a general, a new general to take over, and his name was Henri-Philippe Pétain. Pétain, the famous French general who later on became the head of Vichy France, France, and so forth. Well, in any case, Pétain, he also had a phrase, and that was, they shall not pass. He really didn't say it. Actually, one of his generals said it, but I'm sure he echoed it sometimes. And he said similar things, so it's okay. Many of these World War One pronouncements actually got said by other people than the commander, but that's the way the military is. The commander always takes credit anyway. But Pétain said, they shall not pass. And so the French version of this was to hold and then to counterattack and then hold. In other words, they'd hold, wait for the bombing to stop, counterattack, try to take back some of the land, scrabble back a few yards to make the Germans have to take it again. And the battle then went on month after month after month. This is Pétain, and there are several things that he did, I think, that really made the difference in this defensive battle, because the French, in the end, won, and all they had to do to win was to retain the city of Verdun and those forts around it. One of the things that Pétain said, and this was in opposition to most of his French military colleagues and their thoughts, and that was that instead of the offensive, the morale of the offensive and the famous French bayonet charge and so forth and so on, that in fact in modern circumstances, artillery conquers and infantry holds. So Pétain sent out a first general order to his troops in February 1916 and said, I saw you attack yesterday and you were singing as you rushed into the rushed across no man's land to the German trenches. It was magnificent. But from now on, you won't have to sing. We will annihilate the Germans with artillery fire, and then when you attack, you will have that support with you. So his idea is to pummel the other side so much. We saw these attempts in 1915, but nobody had enough shells. Now they have enough shells. They pummel the other side, and then take it. He had a short way of saying this, and that was le feu tue. Fire kills. It's firepower that kills, not soldiers charging with bayonets. So kill them with the firepower, with the artillery, and then take over. Another thing that Pétain did was to provide a logistical lifeline. It was a road leading to a marshalling town in the rear, about 50 miles away. And Pétain said that road would be considered sacred, and people came to call it the sacred way, la voie sacrée. And that road didn't stop from 1916 until the end of the war, practically, with or certainly throughout the battles of 1916 and 1917. There were always trucks, always carts, everything moving along it. There were workers lining the road, practically, throwing sand onto the road, working on the road as it was being used. It was the sacred way that kept those soldiers, the French, supplied. He was a soldier general. He was one of the few generals in the World War who had actually been in the trenches in any part of it, and he had actually fought the first few days of the war as a colonel in the trenches. Well, Verdun held, but at tremendous cost to everybody involved. The totals are, from February to December 1916, 336,000 German dead, 362,000 French dead. And if you, I put a few references in these slides this week. If you want to see, the older book is Alistair Horn, which is a very wonderful read. And the newer book, also quite moving and a good read, is Malcolm Brown. So we've got Verdun, but what about the Somme? Well, in order to take pressure off the French, the high command decided that General Haig should attack somewhere. And Haig chose the valley of the Somme River, which crossed the Western Front at a kind of right angle in Picardy. And the attack was to jump off on July the 1st. This was Douglas Haig, a Scots general, an old English, British Army infantry officer. And it was to be a huge assault across an 11-mile front, with the French taking an extra mile or two on the southern end of things. So it was a combined assault, but mostly a British assault, to take, in a sense, waste so many Germans, in a sense, waste so much of the materiel and troops of the enemy, that in fact, they'd have to stop attacking Verdun quite so hard. So Haig decided to, you remember, he's the general at Neuve-Chapelle who had first said that he didn't have enough shells to do the job. Well, now he had enough shells too. And the German trenches along this 11-mile, 12-mile front were, the German trenches were bombarded for a week in advance. And there was, the British trenches were filled with young, enthusiastic recruits, many of them who had signed up with their PALS as PALS battalions soldiers. They waded through the bombardment, and at the end of the bombardment, everybody thought all the barbed wire in the middle would be cut. Everybody thought all the Germans in the trenches would be dead. Some officers were confident enough, not to say fatuous enough, that they introduced soccer balls to the squads of their companies and platoons of their companies to see which squad could kick its ball across no man's land first. This, of course, turned into an enormous disaster. It was a race between the British troops going over the top, crossing no man's land to get to the German trenches, and the German machine gunners who were in deep dugouts, surviving the week-long blast, hearing the bombardment stop and racing up to the trenches to assemble their machine guns and start shooting. And in short, the Germans won. That is to say, their machine gunners got to their post in most cases before the British got across no man's land. There was a walking barrage that was supposed to precede the British. Everything looked set. Germans were blown up in on top of huge mines that had been dug all across the front. And the attack launched early in the morning of July the 1st. We'll look at results. 60,000 British casualties, most of them by noon. 20,000 killed, most of them probably by noon. This was the worst day of the British Army. It's almost unimaginable that 20,000 could be killed on one day. And since there were PALS battalions carrying out many of these attacks, then small towns in the Midlands in England got word that of all their young men who marched off to war, two-thirds were dead. It was a huge, huge catastrophe. Most died in machine, the weapon of that day was machine guns, and it was the German machine guns who killed them. But Haig still decided to go on with it. The Allies still decided to go on with it. And the Somme offensive had just begun and ground on up until November. And the totals you see there, Germany at the end had lost 164,000 dead, the French 50,000, British 95,000. So the total best was at 310,000. Another huge battle. However, we get even bigger and more vicious. The Russians also were brought in to make an attack to help relieve the French at Verdun. And the commander of the Russian front and the commander in on the Austro-Hungarian part of the front was General Alexei Brusilov. And Brusilov agreed that there should be a huge offensive in that area of Galicia that we talked about before. So there had already been battles over that territory around Lemberg and so forth. And that's where he decided to put the main weight of the assault. It was a well-organized and well-led assault. It was the best Russian military activity of the war. And the Russians achieved the breakthrough. They went many miles. They drove the Austro-Hungarians many miles. But the KNK forces rallied and were able to stabilize and take back much of the territory. At the end of the thing, in September 1916, if you combine the dead for both sides, it's 1 million dead. The Brusilov offensive was a huge abattoir. It was almost unthinkable. I mean, and you think of the soldiers you see in the pictures, the photograph on the top, marching along to a battle like that, and then the Russians as POWs in the wake of this battle. And you could say the same thing for the Austrians and the Austro-Hungarian army. It was enormously important for the war. It did impact the Germans at Verdun, just like the Somme did. So it changed the course of the war in the West. But moreover, it exhausted the Austrians. It saved Italy from the Austrian assault that was going on the Isonzo front, and it just wore Russia out. In other words, the prelude to the revolutions that we're going to talk about next week, the prelude to the first Russian Revolution of 1917 was the Brusilov Offensive. That was an offensive that should have been a war winner, should have knocked Austria-Hungary out of the war if calculations had been correct, but in fact it didn't succeed. So it's tremendously important for the course of the war, the Brusilov Offensive. So now we've got Verdun, the Somme, and Brusilov. And to put a little cap on that, let's talk about the Battle of Jutland, also 1916. Another huge battle. This one, the only huge naval battle of the war, the only real fleet action of the war. For the most part, the German battle fleet, which had been one of the main causes of the enmity between Britain and Germany in the years before the war, this battle fleet had stayed in its harbors in northern Germany, in Bremen, Bremerhaven, Kiel, Flensburg, and so forth. And they had let the submarines do the work to try to stop the blockade, to try to halt supplies coming into to the British from the United States and other places. And but they waited for a big battle. They changed commanders, and the German admiral in charge decided, Admiral Scheer, this S-C-H-E-E-R, decided to try to bring the British to a battle through some tactics that would destroy their battle cruisers and then allow the ships of the line to be attacked in the way that the Germans wanted them to. If you see if you're looking at the map here, I don't know if the print is legible, but the British will start, let me get my that going, they'll start from their home bases. They're cruising out here. The Germans then move out of their sheltered areas and try to lure the British into a battle, and it happens roughly right up here. So that's the setup for the Battle of Jutland. And the result is that this turned out to be a huge big strength against strength fight, the British Grand Fleet versus the German High Seas Fleet, and after a running battle, a genuine fleet action that lasted over 2 days. Both sides lost much in men. They lost a lot in ships, and both kind of claimed victory, and neither one really had victory. I suppose the British got the better of it, since their navy did not just slink back into port as the German navy did. But that was it for the German navy. They went back to port and sat there, and that's going to have tremendous results at the very end of the war. We'll talk about in the last session, so we need to remember that. I mean, for a naval action, for a land action, the casualties were not high, but here the casualties were huge for naval actions. That is to say, 6,700 British dead, over 3,000 Germans dead, nearly 10,000 both sides. And you realize that's out of a very small pool of nothing like an army, but just these 40 or 50 ships. And another thing was that these were ships that the Germans in particular could ill afford to lose. 25 ships were sunk on both sides. That, technically speaking, the Germans got the better of that too, but on the other hand, they could less afford to lose those ships. The number of wounded was actually quite small compared to the number of killed, because many of these ships were sunk without any survivors at all. So an evaluation of 1916, it was, I'm arguing, a demographic war. And I think that comes through most clearly in the idea of Falkenhayn to bleed France white. But it also takes over as a kind of leitmotif. The British are already, as we've seen, Churchill already made that calculation about the blockade back way back in 1914. But he was a voice in the wilderness. I think what happens in the course of 1916 is that there's some psychological process whereby all the restraints get to be worn off. All the earlier trials lead us to a more brutal way, and in fact a more sterile sort of bean counting way of taking stock in this war. So I'm calling this a demographic war. This also had potentially demographic or results in the way that this attrition occurred during the war. Niall Ferguson, in a book, The Pity of War, it's about 10 or 12 years old, did a little figuring, and he's not my favorite historian, but there's a very interesting piece in which he takes all the figures of Allies versus Central Powers killing of the enemy, and he suggests that that whereas we used to say, well, Germany and Austria and the Ottomans were fighting pretty much the whole world, how could they expect to win? But Ferguson says, if you take all battles and add those together, then what you find is that the Germans and the Austrians were killing Allies at a more rapid rate than the Allies were killing Central Powers. So Ferguson runs that on out, and there's no way to know about the rate of the killing or anything like that, but had the war gone on for years afterwards, then at some point, then the Germans have killed all the Allies, or it doesn't play out that way necessarily, but you see what I mean. It's in the Germans' favor, actually. And I think that's a pretty important thing to think about, and that really emerges in 1916. You saw those battle figures for Verdun, for example, where the Germans were attacking so much and still lost fewer men. There's an enormous amount of fallout from these huge failures, and they were not all failures. I mean, many people argue that the Somme was a victorious battle for General Haig. Many argue that the Brusilov offensive was Brusilov's finest moment, and so forth. But they're failures in a very human sense, and I'll leave it at that. But in addition to the impact that I've discussed in terms of leading up to the Russian Revolution, in terms of weakening the Austrians and Hungarians, drawing off German troops to their front and even to the Italian front in the wake of all this, there is an enormous fallout at home, and that is that Falkenhayn fell from his position as commander-in-chief of the German armies, and the hero of the Eastern Front, the leader of Oberost, the Eastern General Staff, Hindenburg, and Ludendorff, his lieutenant, his great quartermaster general, came to the West, and they took control of the German army, but only under the condition that they could impose a kind of military dictatorship. So this is an enormous home front effect that's going to have colossal and calamitous influence on Western civilization, and we'll talk about that later. So that's an evaluation of 1916. And it's a good place to to transition to our talk about empires in general, our second section of the lecture. This image that you have in front of you on the left, up at the top left, is a place in Ypres, in Belgium, and it's built right along a canal and a wall. The wall was built originally by Vauban, the great fort builder of Louis XIV, and so that's a Vauban wall. Well, let me get my arrow here. A Vauban wall that you see right there. But the structure itself was actually built in the 20s, after World War I. And it's a gate called the Menin Gate, M-E-N-I-N, because it's the gate on the road that goes to the neighboring town of Menin. You see the picture on the right, you see the gate, or at least the place of the gate, the walls coming up there on the road, and the walls broken down over here. That's the same place in the midst of the war, or actually just after the war, because those cars are driving along it, and there were no cars in the they're driving during the war, just soldiers walking out toward a place that was probably the most bombed place on the face of the earth, called Hellfire Corner. But in any case, this structure was built by the British to memorialize the missing soldiers from the battle. Now, there's actually a second cemetery called Tyne Cot that was a military cemetery, and then a huge wall with names on it memorializing soldiers who have been lost and whose bodies have never been found. But so that means for the Ypres, there are two separate cemeteries with two separate memorials for the lost. And on the interior walls, you can see this gentleman looking at the interior walls. Everything underneath this enormous structure over here, everything on the inside, every little space on the wall has names chiseled in it. And these are missing persons whose bodies were never found. So this is called the Menin Gate, and they have an impressive ceremony there. I'll tell you about that in some of the context. But the gentleman here is looking at the names of the troops who died, and I'd like you to notice those names if it's large enough for you to read those. Bawa Singh, Bhagat Singh, Sohan Singh, etc., etc. So these are all Sikh names. They're all Indian names. And if you look over much of the interior, you see Sikh names, you see Muslim names, you see names from all over Asia, names of several different kinds, and then standard English and Scottish and Irish names as well. They're all mixed in together. And this is one thing that impressed the inhabitants of Ypres when this gate was dedicated in 1926. They said, "You mean these young men came from all over the world to defend our town?" And that's one way of telling it. I mean, in a sense, that's perfectly true. So this person, Bhagat Singh, came from India to defend Ypres in the end. And that's the way they kind of look at it. There's actually quite an impressive ceremony. They play a combination of all the British bugle calls. It's called Last Post, and that happens every night. And it's happened every night since 1926, except for the years 1940, when the Germans marched in, and the local fire department, who does the bugling, the bugle calling, and the local fire department buried the bugles so the Germans wouldn't get them. But the Day of Liberation, they dug up the bugles, and they had Last Post. That was in 1944, and every night since then. And sometimes there are huge crowds of people within this area inside the gate, and that's where the ceremony is. Sometimes there's nobody. But they commemorate these deaths nonetheless. I think it's a moving kind of experience. And if you ever get a chance to go to Ypres, don't miss last post. Well, my point here is that the British brought imperial troops, that the whole empire was locked into this struggle for Ypres and for all the Western Front and for all the battle fronts. There was hardly a force that didn't consist of many different nationalities from the British Commonwealth or empire. And indeed, if I can extend this just a little bit, if you look at all the powers in the war, by golly, they were all empires. Look at the Entente empires on the left side of the slide here. So Britain, France, and Russia, and Italy, and Japan, and Portugal, and the United States, they were all empires. Romania was not really an empire in any sense. Serbia and Greece, you could argue a little bit, but really not huge, big empires. But I've got to say, even poor little Belgium, the poor little country that got raped in order for this war to start, Belgium had the most vicious of all the African empires. This is what the Heart of Darkness by Conrad is all about. It's this vicious takeover of Africa. So all of the countries, even those sinned against, were imperial powers. And that's something to think about. On the Central Power side, well, they were all called empires. Das Deutsche Reich, the German Empire, and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the Ottoman Empire. Bulgaria, we'll give a free pass. Bulgaria was really not an empire. But you get the picture here. So they're all empires. It really was this huge war of empire. So let me make some comments about this here, and then we'll move on to some case studies. First of all, the original Entente Cordiale was an agreement about colonies. We've talked about this already. The British and the French just decided to end their disputes over this territory, that territory. You take that one, we'll take that one. They sat down at a green table, and they just swapped as if they had cards trading across the table. So that was the friendly understanding. That was that leg of the Triple Entente. Then the final leg of the Triple Entente, the 1907 British-Russian Convention, was hinged on beginning of a partition of Persia. It never did quite come to partition. It just came to what they call condominium, but they divided Persia, a perfectly good, independent country, which had just made itself a working constitution and set up a real working parliament. They divided this country in half and occupied separate parts of it and ran it as their own. So the whole British, French, Russian alliance, there's a similar story with the Russians earlier on in the 1890s. This is all an imperial kind of creation, and for imperial reasons. In other words, these were empires, and they made the alliances because they were empires and for reasons of empire. The crises leading to the war, to make another point, these were all related to imperial affairs among the participating powers. There was along the way much imperial cooperation before the war, but the rivalries were very, very important nonetheless. I remember now to look at the chat. Let me just stop and answer a few of these questions before we get too terribly far from the battle part of it. Malcolm asks, did the Germans and other forces understand how deadly interlocking fields of fire are with machines? Did they use this tactic? Yes, Malcolm, all the time. In fact, they were already using that tactic in the Russo-Japanese War in 1904-1905. They understood it extremely well, and that's in all the manuals from all countries there. So I hope that that helps. Let me look at some of the points above. Let's see. I don't see any questions we can't cover at the end. Okay. German square tanks. Leslie asks, why did the Germans and the Austro-Hungarians have a better kill ratio? Well, that's one for the ages. I mean, they were just really good at what they did. Their weapons were as good or better as anything the enemy had, and that's a good question. Somebody else has given an answer there, and I think that's a good idea. Malcolm wants me to talk about the Anglo-Persian Oil Company. Yes, we've talked about that a little bit, and I just went over it. So very good. I think we have that all, or a lot of it cleared up. And so there was a lot of imperial cooperation, but there was a lot of casual invasiveness and brutality in that empire. At the beginning of the war. The very first moves, in other words, the cables sent out from London, that is to say, you know, August 4th we declare war, and later that day we're sending out the first things we think of to do. And for the British, here's what happened. They sent out the cable gets there on the 6th. Okay, maybe they sent it the 5th, but it's immediate. They send to the army command in Australia to gather New Zealanders and Australians and go take German Samoa. They said there was a crucial wireless station operating on German Samoa that had to be shut down. Now, I submit to you that in the state of wireless, which was not exactly in its infancy, but very crude, and in a remote port in Samoa, this was not the real reason for the attack. But all of the German possessions were taken this way in the beginning days of the war. So the empires were thinking immediately, aha, we use this war to expand. All right? That's really important. In the same way in Africa, a Franco-British force immediately, just a few days after the opening of the war, took Togoland. The New Zealand force, along with some Australians and Japanese naval assistance, took German Samoa 4 days later. I don't even mention that the Japanese immediately snapped up all the North Pacific German possessions in the Pacific Islands, etc. German Cameroon took a little bit longer. It fell to a Franco-British Belgian force on September 27th. So you get the idea. You understand what I'm saying, that this is an imperial conflict here. In the photograph above, these are New Zealanders. And as I suggest in the caption, are they in France or rather in Turkey? They fought there too. Or maybe German Samoa. I don't think the picture's from there, but you get the point. It could be in Palestine, could be in Egypt, could be any of these places all over the world that these people from little peaceful towns in New Zealand went to fight the war. And the photograph on the bottom is kind of small, but you can see this. These are British officers occupying German Samoa, that great prize of World War I. I glance over at the questions, and let's see. Philip Sargent says, how do you define the United States as an empire when it doesn't seem to fit the empire model of those with colonies? Because the United States had colonies. It didn't call them colonies, but then most of the empires didn't call their possessions colonies. They called them protectorates or condominiums or international cities or whatever. But the United States quite specifically decided, as McKinley said, to go out and engage in the empire abroad. And so we took the Philippines in 1898-99 and pacified the revolts that happened there. We had possession of Puerto Rico, so that ipso facto makes the United States an empire. So there's these gains of August and the imperial race pressed on. Let me talk about the British Empire for a little bit, because I want to talk about this enveloping kind of imperial approach to the war. Canada was, from 1867 on, a kind of autonomous part of the empire. It was a dominion that was on its own. It recognized as its queen, the Queen of England, as its monarch, the Queen of England. But it ran its own country, and what happened was that the conservative, you could almost read it, nationalist Prime Minister Robert Borden immediately called for a declaration of war in Canada, immediately declared war the same day as the British. 33,000 men volunteered immediately. They had had goals of 28,000, and 33,000 volunteered. People were enthusiastically going to the war. Canadians volunteered. There was no conscription in Canada up until 1917, and there was a huge crisis about having it then. Canada also contributed enormous quantities of shipping, enormous raw materials, food shipments, and so forth. And out of a population of 7.2 million, 630,000 would serve, and about 60,000 would die in the course of the war. The things to look for, and that we will look for along the way, are the conscription crisis of 1917. We'll talk about that when we talk about conscription as a whole. And it's important to note that the great Canadian battle of the war, and there were many battles all over the war, but the great combined Canadian arms battle with artillery and the Canadian, all Canadian divisions involved, was the famous Battle of Vimy Ridge, and we will talk more about that later. So I just checking the questions there. Sorry for the pause for navigation. Let's go to Australia, British Empire, Australia. And we're not going to go to all the parts of the British Empire, since that would be physically impossible to cover in our time tonight. But it's an autonomous dominion also since 1901. It's about 5 million, so fewer people than Canada. 416,000 were mobilized into the military, and about 60,000 died, same number as Canada. The Australians, as we've seen, immediately set up to capture a German New Guinea, informing the Australia and New Zealand Corps, the Army Corps, the ANZACs. Australians would train in England and Egypt, and fought in France, Belgium, Turkey, Palestine. So these young men, these even some of them kids from farms in the outback and ranches in the outback, are going to war and fighting in places all over the world. I mean, that's the important dynamic I'm hoping to illustrate here. New Zealand. Just over a million inhabitants, 103,000 served in the war, including 2,227 Maoris, 458 Pacific Islanders. New Zealand suffered about among the highest per capita casualty rates of any participant in the war, in the top five or six, I believe. The Balkan countries tended to have the highest numbers of dead, but New Zealand had a very high rate. 18,500 were killed, and about 50,000 were wounded. And you see a photograph there of the Kiwis getting off the boat in Le Havre or someplace in France. I believe it's Le Havre. South Africa is an interesting case. South Africa had been, of course, the scene of the huge Boer War, where the British got bogged down from 1899 to 1901 or 1902, and had completely had to resort to, really invented a concentration camp in effect, or helped invent it, and in fighting these Dutch settlers, or mainly Dutch settlers there. It was surprising that the country came together as well as it did in the wake of the Boer War. But it did. In fact, it came together partly because the British, after having burned so many Afrikaner homes in the north of the country, they tended to give the government over to a substantial way to the Afrikaner elites. So there, Louis Botha and his family were prominent. These were prominent Afrikaner politicians, and they became prominent leaders of the new South Africa. All the holdings of the De Beers Diamond Company and Cecil Rhodes and all that British presence managed to come to a modus vivendi with the Afrikaners, and so there was a kind of a conciliation there. Well, when war broke out 10 days after it, it was clear that there was a lot of sentiment against it, and a lot of it came from these Afrikaners, many of whom, way back in the 1880s and 1890s, had been quite pro-German. I mean, they were very, very sympathetic to the Germans. And one of the leading military men of the South Africa Defense Force, Christiaan Beyers, said with the opening of the war, "It is sad that the war is being waged against the barbarism of the Germans. We have forgiven but not forgotten all the barbarities committed in our own country during the South African War," which was quite true. In fact, Beyers joined a revolt called the Maritz Revolt. It was a gathering of commandos of these mounted squads, hoping to use the occasion of the war to take their country back from the British. This may be the first people in the war to see the war as a kind of fulfillment. Later on, we're going to talk at length about Murray Rothbard's essay, War as Fulfillment, and it's about the American intellectuals and how they, especially the progressive ones, and how they saw the war as a way of fulfilling some need. And John Dewey comes to mind. Some of you have read these materials and know that these sections of Rothbard and other thinkers. But this is going to be universal. I mean, this is the first time I mention it, but we're going to mention it many, many more times. People see the war going, and they say, aha, I can use this war to advance cause A or cause B or cause C. And the Maritz Revolt is pretty close to that. A lot of Afrikaners had planned for this. And as the war approached, they said, well, it looks like there's going to be a war, and good show, we'll get together and take back our country. In fact, they didn't. The revolt was put down when a young and brilliant Afrikaner officer, really an attorney, who was just suddenly brought into the military, named Jan Smuts, more on him in a moment, led a force, a large South Africa Defense Force, and ended the Maritz Revolt, and those revolters were all put into jail for several years. But in any case, he led that same force into German Southwest Africa, that's now the country of Namibia, and took that for the British Empire. And also there was a continuous struggle launched in from South Africa to German East Africa, or Tanganyika, as it was called. So the South Africans were quite active in terms of supporting the British Empire militarily, quite active in Africa itself. But there were also enlistments for the Western fronts and other fronts. So South Africans fought in all these different places that I've been talking about, Australians and Canadians fighting. Finally, there is this factor, it's not crucial, but there is this factor that the British, especially because they were inflating their currency, and went off the gold standard, as they did, as we looked at last week, or the week before, they needed gold reserves, and there were, in fact, gold shipments sent from the gold mines in South Africa that kept them afloat. So South Africa is really important in the overall logistical sort of economy of the war for the empire. Let me say a few words about Jan Smuts. He's a very, very important figure for the war, and indeed an important figure, a world historical figure for the 20th century. He was an Afrikaner, as his name indicates, educated at Cambridge, however, in England, super smart guy. And he came back to South Africa and became a close subordinate of Cecil Rhodes, the head of the De Beers Diamond Company, and the great imperializer of Africa. Smuts did side with the Afrikaners during the war, and he led one of those commandos against the British, but he was basically rehabilitated after the war in the South African politics, and he became a very prominent politician in the years leading up to World War I, and then, as we've seen, led the defense force to put down the Maritz Revolt of German Southwest Africa. He's basically making a career as the most successful, this attorney, as the most successful South African general. In 1917, Smuts was called to London to serve on the Imperial War Cabinet. That was an idea of David Lloyd George's, to try to make all these imperial connections work together more closely. And in London and in Cape Town and Pretoria, Jan Smuts was a close associate of Ernest Oppenheimer, who is taking over in the process of, he's already taken over as the war starts, the De Beers Diamond Company, and who is on the verge of his huge deal to create from the De Beers interests and J.P. Morgan interests the largest mining company in the world, the Anglo-American Mining Company. That's in 1917 that will come to fruition. So it's right in the middle of the war. And Smuts was a close associate of Oppenheimer. Smuts was very disapproving of Pershing when Pershing came to Europe with the American Expeditionary Force. Pershing was, of course, haven't said yet, but he was the leader of the American armies on the ground in Europe. And indeed insisted with Lloyd George that Pershing should be dismissed, and suggested that he himself could be a replacement, because he thought all the Americans should be is just replacement troops in the line for the British. I mention these connections between Smuts and indirectly with Morgan and these statesmen at the top of the heap for a reason that you'll see in a minute. By the way, Smuts also, after the war, is going to take Woodrow Wilson's idea of the League of Nations and run with it. He, in fact, adopts it as something very close to his heart, and he's the one who basically wrote out the system of the League of Nations. And indeed, after the next war, Jan Smuts is going to write the preamble to the UN Charter. He becomes a leading internationalist through the war, and becomes a charter member of that sort of round table group that's discussed in a number of places that Rothbard discusses, of the British internationalists who are representatives of banking interests in England and the United States. So Smuts, a real creature of empire, you'd say. Let me mention India for a little bit. It plays a very, very important role in the war. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Indians worked as longshoremen and fabricated war materials and so forth and so on. The empire used this as an invaluable a supply of manpower. But the Indians also supplied military troops, a lot of military troops, in fact. Over a million served overseas. The Indian Corps, there were four divisions served on the Western Front, and those divisions then went to the Middle East and fought in the battles there for the years 1917-1918. 74,000 Indians died in the war, and it's an important war for India in that it crystallizes this desire to have an independent country too. It crystallizes the independence movement. I mean, there are already separate groups like the Congress Party and various others who intend someday to have an independent India. And they all work together, in a sense, with the British because they're using the same idea of fulfillment that the South African Boers were using, that these Afrikaners were using, in that we can use the war for this purpose. You know, I might point out that at this point, that's the same. That's exactly what the two competing Irish factions said. They were about to go to war when the war started, and they're pretty much a part of the empire too. And there was a war brewing in the summer of 1914 between the Ulstermen and the Irish over home rule and that damnable question, as a famous prime minister called the Irish question. And then both sides formed up, took their paramilitary units and formed up divisions to go to fight for the British, because they said we can use this war to show the British that our hearts are in the right place, and then we get what we want, either independence in the one case or remain with England in the other case. And the Indians, to some extent, did this. They fight in a lot of places. They do guard duty. They train. But these Indians, to get back to India, have a long list of places, including Transcaspia and including, very early in the war, being taken up to China by British officers and fighting a little bit in Tsingtao, the German, the head of the German possessions in the sphere of influence that the Germans had in China. So Indian troops were important for the war in a multiplicity of ways, and it's important to mention that. Indeed, I wanted to make a small statement about another creature of empire, Mohandas Gandhi, who played a role in the war as well. Gandhi was, I don't know if everybody knows this, but he was an Indian who went to South Africa. Well, he was educated in London, and he went to South Africa to work with the Indian population there and work on rights for that population. He also fought in the Boer War, but not fighting. He was in the war as an ambulance corpsman, and there you see his photograph in his uniform there. After the Boer War, he encouraged the British South Africa administration to recruit Indians to fight in a Zulu War that came up at that time. And indeed, in 1915, he went back to India because he had interest in imperial politics, but also Indian politics. And there he began to recruit soldiers, just as he tried to get the British to do in 1906 in South Africa. In India, he promoted recruitment and indeed stumped the country giving recruitment speeches. In a leaflet entitled An Appeal for Enlistment, Gandhi wrote, "To bring about such a state of things, that is more self-rule in India, we should have the ability to defend ourselves, that is, the ability to bear arms and to use them. If we want to learn the use of arms with the greatest possible dispatch, it is our duty to enlist ourselves in the army." Elsewhere, he said, "If we participate in the war, we show not only that we can use these arms, but that we are worthy of independence." So another kind of fulfillment case there. And there you see Gandhi in 1918. A bit about the French Empire at war. These troops that you see in this photograph are troops who've been decorated from the Senegalese tirailleurs. Most of the French imperial troops were in outfits designated as tirailleurs, which is the French word for skirmisher, or you might say ranger. Special units, often thought of as light infantry in the classical sense, they were highly regarded soldiers. The French brought them into the line at almost the first instance of the war, and not just the Senegalese, but people from all over the empire. 190,000 Maghrebians, that is Tunisians, Moroccans, Algerians, fought in the war. There's a photograph of the 4th Tunisian tirailleur, that's that word I'm not pronouncing all that well. That's in 1917. I think it's very interesting to see this French Indochinese marine infantry, the Tirailleurs Annamite, in a rest camp in Salonika. So that's from Southeast Asia. That's from French Indochina and a group off there. So there were hundreds of thousands of these troops in the British War II, and also troops working as what was called coolie labor, sometimes digging in rear areas of Western Front, sometimes working at docks and so forth and so on. Now, here are a couple of questions. Let's see. Did anyone in the Empire's forecast that if they trained the locals to fight or support the war, then the locals would use this training against the foreign invader years later? Well, I think that was a big discussion, yeah. But I think the British thought they had no choice in that, because essentially the essential problem in this war for the British was manpower, and so they had to solve it through imperial means. Same with the Germans. Their essential problem was manpower. How to have enough people to make the shells and to fire the shells off and to man the trenches. So I think they had no choice. There was certainly talk about this, and a lot of generals in India, especially the old Anglo-Indian ruling class, the old British Raj types who were disgusted by this and thought the Indians should only be used in subservient roles. But of course, that discussion had been going on even with regard to the Indian administration for many years. And of course, the British had always had troops. In the earliest days of the British Empire, they had Indian troops because there weren't British troops, not very many. The Seven Years' War was fought out in India, mostly by French officers leading Indian troops and British officers leading Indian troops. So the idea of sepoy troops, it goes back a long way and is a part of the whole history of India. So, I mean, it's not as if they armed the Indians for the first time. There are many Indian formations which have existed for well over 100 years and have elite status and elite rank and so forth and so on. Just to move on, I hope these interruptions don't matter. I want to talk a little bit at the end of our time together here, the end of the lecture, about money and the Imperial War, because the money issue, the finance issue, is so crucially important, and it comes into the imperial way of looking at this war. That's J.P. Morgan, by the way, looking over all of you, staring each of you in the face with his cold stare that reduced even famous persons to chilly chills on their arms and so forth and so on. In general, the Western empires had created empires both by, and we mentioned this just a bit, both by conquest, you know, raw military conquest, and by financial manipulation. You may recall I mentioned that the British in Egypt were first manipulating the finances, and then they took over the country. But in taking it over, then they bombed Alexandria, too. So there's all this that works together. This is often called gunboat diplomacy. If you read that, for those of you who want to read a really heavy-duty book, Dana G. Monroe, an old State Department diplomat, wrote a book called Gunboat Diplomacy and Dollar Diplomacy in the early part of the century. And that's tough, but it shows you how this works. In other words, there's a gunboat out in the bay, and then you offer to loan money and so forth and so on. So there's a lot of financial manipulation, and I've discussed this already, but I'm reemphasizing it here. So they loan these other powers money for improvements, and then when they default, then they take over in some way. And once they are in, or even before they're in, they offer to finance railroads, or maybe to collect the customs of the country. There are inroads there, and then they took these places over. But sometime in the late part of the century, the international bankers who financed these, who were the investment core of this this whole kind of process, saw that the gold standard stopped them from making even more money than they would have. So from the 1870s on, the these bankers worked to create a more flexible system, as they called it, a more progressive system than the gold standard. Many of you know that the classical gold standard prevailed in the 19th century. It's an ideal that many of us would like to see in place once again. And it was just a hard money regime in which people exchanged gold, and insofar as there was currency, and there certainly was currency, that currency stood for a piece of gold in the bank. But it broke down in the years before World War I, and we talked about that already as a part of the cause of the war, because countries now could manipulate their currency and move vast quantities of wealth from their populations to the coffers of the central government. And without that, the war wouldn't have lasted for 6 months. So the gold standard broke down, and Murray Rothbard discusses this very question. And I don't know if you can read all that text. I know you're not supposed to put big quantities of text on a PowerPoint slide. I know this. However, I think the rule is put out of effect when you're quoting Murray Rothbard. I think any amount of Murray Rothbard text can go on a slide. I think that's probably in the PowerPoint instructions. If the classical gold standard worked so well, he says, why did it break down? It broke down because governments were entrusted with the task of keeping their monetary promises, of seeing to it that pounds, dollars, francs were always redeemable in gold. It was not gold that failed, it was the folly of trusting government to keep its promises. To wage the catastrophic war of World War I, each government had to inflate its own supply of paper and bank currency. You see that? You see why? To pay for all of the stuff that we've been talking about, all the week-long artillery bombardment in which we send hundreds of thousands of shells over to the other side. So, to continue with Rothbard, so severe was this inflation that it was impossible for the warring governments to keep their pledges, and so they went off the gold standard. That is, declared their own bankruptcy shortly after ending the war, as we have seen. All except the United States, which entered the war late and did not inflate the supply of dollars enough to endanger redeemability. It did inflate it, but not enough to endanger redeemability. So this is a part of the scene. It's a very crucial part that there was a plan to move into a different phase of existence, a plan by elites that were partly these international bankers and partly their minions and partly folks working for other kinds of causes. We've already mentioned the financial connections, these imperial connections between the Russians and the French. The Franco-Russian alliance, you recall, was cobbled together in 1892. Even before that, the French had agreed to float Russian loans to help with Russian industrialization. On the French, the very fat French bond market, so that French middle class people were loaning money to Russia, and there was no way they wanted to see Russia lose this war, and certainly no way they wanted to see Russia get out of the war once the war was going. But as we've seen, these huge loans were floated, and they were brokered by the Banque de Paris, et Pays-Bas, that is the this vast Paris international bank, other tools of the banking enterprises of the Paris-based Rothschilds, the J.P. Morgan's sister company from J.P. Morgan and Company in the United States. In England was called Morgan and Grenfell. In Paris it was called Morgan, Harge and See. And then there were other banks that brokered these. So the international bankers were very much a part of that regime, as you can imagine. And these issues continued on. In fact, after the Russo-Japanese War and the Russian embarrassment in that war, they needed even more loans. And then there was a 1905 revolution in Russia, and they needed even more loans. So this continued on. And I've got some references there if you want to read all these details. It's quite a story. flip back to America, and we get another little piece of this. By the late 1890s, groups of theoreticians in the United States, were working on what would later be called the Leninist theory of capitalist imperialism. The theory was originated not by Lenin, but by advocates of imperialism, centering around such Morgan-oriented friends and grain trusters. Wait, can everybody hear me? I've just heard somebody else join in. Can everybody hear me? I heard a strange noise from my computer. Maybe it was just a passing radio. Can everybody hear me? Okay. Bob hears me. Leslie's. Okay, great. Thanks. Good. Excellent. You never know. It would be horrible. I mean, if Hunt Tooley were giving a lecture in a forest and not hooked up the internet, would anybody hear? Would it really be a lecture, you know? So to go back to Rothbard, he says that the whole theory of capitalist imperialism was coming from Morgan-oriented friends, progressive guys, the brain trusters around Theodore Roosevelt, Henry Adams, Brooks Adams, Alfred Thayer Mahan, the Henry Cabot Lodge, etc. It was necessary, Rothbard says, for Western governments to engage in outright imperialist or neo-imperialist ventures, which would force other countries to open their markets for American products. So you see that this was actually a purpose. J.P. Morgan's imperial connections are the clearest of all. His father, Junius Morgan, was an American, but eventually a London investment banker, and eventually he was the United States financial representative to Britain during the Civil War. And his son would later become a British purchasing agent to the United States during World War I. As I've said, the company Morgan Grenfell, that is Morgan's company in London, was a British company and very much in the imperial finance center. He had many connections with Rhodes. Later on, he would buy a partnership in with the De Beers company. There were all kinds of cultural connections that J.P. Morgan fostered with Britain. Then there are the neutral and wartime loans to the Entente powers. J.P. Morgan and Company arranged the biggest foreign loan in Wall Street history in 1915, the $500 million Anglo-French loan. That's huge. Morgan also acted as a purchasing agent for the United States, as I've mentioned, for the allies in the United States. And then, of course, he's busily combining imperial companies as we go throughout the war. There's a good analysis of some Rothbard comments that David Gordon has made. And just to take a couple of quotations from this, it fits in with this theme I'm attempting to get across. Rothbard makes it clear that the Morgan interests aimed at much more than profits. To this very powerful group, the interests of Great Britain and her empire were paramount. Rothbard's analysis of all this, now we're quoting Rothbard, he said the Morgans played a substantial role in bringing the United States into the war on Britain's side. And as head of the Fed, Benjamin Strong obligingly doubled the money supply to finance America's role in the war effort. We're back with Warden again, who says Benjamin Strong, the governor of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, was by far the most influential figure in the Federal Reserve. He entered into close association with Montague Norman, governor of the Bank of England. At Norman's behest, Strong inflated the U.S. monetary supply in order to enable Britain to maintain in operation the gold exchange standard. So we're really very deeply into this kind of imperial mode. Well, to sum up the lecture, I just want to say I think what we're looking at is in 1916, the war is becoming ever more costly. It's becoming ever more brutally demographic, and that these imperial connections were involved from the beginning, but they come to be even more important in so many ways that I think we need to look through this imperial lens to make sense of the war. And this is above all the case with the British Empire, J.P. Morgan axis. And we have to lay that groundwork before we talk about the entry of the United States, and that's all next week. So that's it for the lecture. Now we start as many questions as you can come up with, and I will first of all run up through these questions that I haven't had a chance to look at in the last couple of minutes, and try to answer those. Let's see. Start from the. Well, let me move up and see if there are any I didn't answer that are far up on the. I think I got him. If somebody asks a question that didn't get answered earlier, just ask it again, and I'll try to I'll address it now. I don't see it very far up. Let's see. Thank you, Steve. I like that. A lecture by any other name is still a lecture. Oh yeah. Cam says, could you suggest any books on defense contracts in World War One? I don't know of any, Cam, and not right off the bat. I mean, we could look that up. Probably a JSTOR search in the historical literature. This sounds to me like the kind of thing that might have been covered in Business History Review or maybe Diplomatic History earlier on, but I'd have to take a look on that. I don't know of any of those right off the bat. Malcolm asks, do you know of any books that detail the bond market through history and how it has financed or incentivized wars? And that's a really good topic, and I don't know of a book that does that. I mean, I know of a lot of books that touch on it. In other words, all the sources that I gave above in the last three or four slides, these books touch on that. But I don't know of any book that's on it. So there may be one, but I just don't know about it. I think I might. I mean, I've worked to try to get that. How do we get access to JSTOR? Well, that's a good question. If you're in any way affiliated with the university or can get a membership to a university library or maybe even a local library, if they are members of JSTOR, you can get on it. Otherwise, I think you can buy a membership in it, and I don't know how expensive it is. It's a very handy tool. I mean, it goes into the real scholarly journals, and of course, you have to use your judgment there. But there's a lot of good information in there. Just people, often scholars, even if they might not agree with the conclusions that you want to take, they still produce the research and they put that in the articles. So. That's what I would say. Cam, do you have another answer? Do you have a way to get into that? Catherine says it's expensive. I don't know. Maybe there's a way to do this that I don't know about. Let me jump down to the Q&A. Section. And Steve Weiss says, Is it fair to say that the emphasis on empire came about as a result of the escalating cost of the war? That is, did each empire seek greater payback for their investments in the world conflict? I think that's a great way to put it. I wish I'd put it that way myself, Steve. That's pretty much at the core of what I'm attempting to push here. So yeah, I think that's very true. I think they. It's the end result. Conflict is the end result of all this empire, and people had expected that for a long time. So I think that's a good way of understanding it. This is paper description that okay, I don't believe that item from Malcolm is a, I don't see a question there. Okay, so I will wait for it. Let me see. Nathan Hayes asks, do you know of any ties of the Chinese Opium Wars to the World War? Well, Nathan, I think that the ties that we made, I mean, just from the whole imperialist march from the 1830s and then the 1850s when those Opium Wars took place to the present. In other words, in the general concept, empire, as we've seen, was intimately connected with the running and the financing of the war, and the Opium Wars were intimately connected with the financing of empire. I think each generation of these imperialists has attempted to, well, I think they, I mean, they're brilliant people, and they figure out new ways to make money, new ways to create an environment where they can make money and they can be in control. I really think that there's a sense here in which the brains trust of the British Empire and also the brains trust of these international bankers felt like that they knew better than other people in the world and therefore could make a better world, and that they followed this track out to its logical conclusion. So I think they're connected certainly in that way. Okay. Any more? I don't see any more questions right at the moment. Oh, thank you very much, Rob. I appreciate that. Thank you very much. I've really tried to get some good pictures and things. Catherine gives us a JSTOR pricing. Cam, I don't believe that JSTOR allow, I mean, I've heard of people trying, and of course I've never had to, although maybe someday I will have to, but at this point, I think they charge you. But it really, I mean, if you were doing heavy duty work, it would really be worth it. I mean, it would be, if it's no more than like a subscription to a magazine, it would really be absolutely worth it. Malcolm says, I'm confused from the reading, as it says that David Lloyd George was against the war prior, then became a big supporter. Why the change? Oh, well, David Lloyd George changed his mind on many kinds of things. David Lloyd George is one of the most fascinating characters in the whole scene. He was a Welshman. He's the only English prime minister who was not a native English speaker. He spoke Welsh in his house at home when he was a little kid. And he makes his way through this tumultuous system to become an official, a British administrator. He becomes Chancellor of the Exchequer, in other words, over finances. He then becomes Minister of Munitions during the war, and then finally at the end of 1915, he becomes war prime minister. And he changed his mind often. People hated him for that. But, I mean, essentially, I don't recall that he was, I mean, he was, like many liberals, he talked about not getting into the war because the liberals were supposed to be against the war. Even the unionist liberals, who were the sort of, you might say, national liberals of England. But, so they all had to talk a little bit of a fight, but he was certainly the man they went to when they wanted a tough guy in office to make the big changes in the British economy, changes of a kind that he had already started to make. Louis Maynard says, in England, a text in the lectures said that the Union members of England doubled from 1914 to 1918. Was it the same in other nations? In what ways did the Union laborers, labor unions gather force during the war? Well, we're going to talk about that in the weeks to come, but essentially, Louis, the story is that the states concluded at this time that they should work with the labor unions, that World War I affected a sea change in labor relations, because at this point, the government set up the official recognition of the unions and relate to them and negotiate with them and act as if they're these sort of officials or semi-official entities. So that's the story overall. But the British unions were especially ready to strike. And they struck many times, especially as the war dragged on, especially in 1917, 1918. But the German unions did too. I think union membership didn't go down in Germany either, and probably went up. But that's an interesting fact. I didn't know that membership doubled. That is an interesting process. Let's see. Where are we? You know, I think it's called dollar diplomacy, and it's about gun blow diplomacy and this financial diplomacy. And the author is Dana, D-A-N-A, G, Munro, M-U-N-R-O. Okay, so Malcolm asks, did you cover in a previous lecture how France was waging an economic war on Germany by causing a run on their banks prior to World War One? If not, could you comment on that? I don't know anything about that, Malcolm, so I'm sorry I cannot comment on it. And I don't know of any runs on banks, so this is if this is the case, it's something that's escaped me. John Anderson, I appreciate your top 14 World War One books. Yay! But I was wondering what you thought of Robert Massey's book, Dreadnought, and its telling of the events that lead to war. Oh, yeah, it's a good book. It's just not on my top 14 list. Massey's a great, great writer, and all of his books are fun. And these professional writers who are historians and write history, I don't mean popular in any pejorative sense, but write history for everybody, regular readers and not just other scholars. Massey's among the very best, and of course Barbara Tuchman is very interesting to read, although extremely kind of socialist in orientation. And there are a few more I think a lot of. I'll tell you another good set of books on the whole war, and I couldn't figure out quite how to get these in. And that is, these are the books of Lynn MacDonald, L-Y-N MacDonald, who is a British woman who was a BBC documentary maker, and in the late 60s somehow did a documentary on World War One veterans and realized how many there were in the late 60s left in England, and of course that was 50 years after the war. So in 68 or 69 she started thinking about doing a big interview project and how she would go about that. And she realized that she was suddenly getting so many interviews that there was no way to catalog those. So Lynn MacDonald had a friend who was a teacher at a local, basically eighth grade or ninth grade in a British school. And she talked to him about it. He was a history teacher. And he said, well, my kids can do it. We can catalog all these things and keep track and rewrite and clarify. So this is what she did, and this resulted in 8 books, and they are wonderful books. The last one came out a few years ago, so she's been writing these books since the early 70s until just 5 or 6 years ago. Lynn MacDonald, she's written one on the Somme, she's written one on Passchendaele, the Battle of Passchendaele, and they are absolutely fabulous books. They're mostly in the words of these men that she interviewed, so they're soldiers' accounts. It's not a bird's eye view of the war. It's the snail's eye view of these guys who were, you know, in the trenches and so forth. Those are very good books. But I didn't know how to get those. I didn't know how to get those into the mix. Okay. There is a hyperlink in the wiki for David Lloyd George referring to the Agadir crisis. In that link, there was a short paragraph below. Can you please let us know if and how France was waging economic war on Germany? Oh, you know, Malcolm, I'll have to look into this. I really don't have time to, you know, go into this link and read it. So I'll have to read that in another in a sitting and get back to you on that. I just don't think I can answer questions by reading long texts here, so I think I'll read that over and I'll try to get back to you on that. Maybe I'll just answer it on the forum, if that's okay. What do you think of the 10-episode series on Hugh Strachan's book? I don't know the series, Cam, I haven't read. I mean, I haven't seen that. Louis Maynard says Britain was interested in recapturing Palestine. What were the reasons at that time, and did the rest of the Entente pursue that goal? Only the British cared much about Palestine. The French were glad to see that the British were putting pressure on the Ottoman Empire, but that was all imperial. I mean, the only reason that the British they've been attempting to dominate that whole region, and they had dominated it through their insistent pressure on Turkey through the 19th century. Therefore, they didn't really need to take Palestine. But once they took Egypt, once the canal was there, they needed what was on the other side, and hence they wanted to take Palestine and set it up after the war so that they would control it. So that was pure and simple. And in fact, in the internal British correspondence, they don't make any bones about that. That's just the goal for after the war. Can you comment in detail on what was Haig's policy of attrition? Well, he was trying to kill so many Germans that they'd have to be replaced by other Germans who were fighting at Verdun, and then those Germans would come and be killed too. He just wanted to grind away, and so at the beginning of the battle, he thought maybe there could be a breakthrough, as he had hoped for the previous year at Neuve-Chapelle. But in fact, after breakthrough did not occur, and after it became totally obvious that there would be no breakthrough in any place on the Somme battlefield, on this huge battlefield, you know, however deep by 11 or 12 miles across, that he kept on attacking. He kept the attacks going day after day, day in, new attacks, new assaults, and he was trying to kill Germans. So that's what I mean by policy of attrition, or what anybody would mean by Haig's policy of attrition. He goes from breakthrough to killing Germans and having them fire off their artillery and their guns and all those things. So attrition just means being people using up all their resources, and that's what he wanted to do. How close were British, French, and Russian financial circles before the war? Extremely close. They were cooperating on all these imperial deals. Nearly every single one of them was a joint deal. I mentioned before in the first lecture that the China loans of the years before World War I loomed very large in this kind of cooperation. But, you know, they worked together, and the Germans and British were all linked together in a railroad in the Ottoman Empire in the years before the war. There was a lot of cooperation. They didn't keep very separate. Very separate at all. They were quite close. Let's see. Let me look on the bottom one. Which nation, Nathan says, which nation besides the U.S. had the largest capital structure at this time? And if Nathan, I'm not sure what the term capital structure means, but if it just means are we talking about the country with the most capital? If that's the case, it would be Britain. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And in fact, the United States had just surpassed Britain a few years earlier, in about 1900. So if that's a question, but if there's something in that term, capital structure, that I'm not understanding, if it's a specialized term, then maybe you could explain that. Meanwhile, I'll go back up to Louis, who says, everywhere in the texts we had to read, we had the commentaries of Keynes on the Treaty of Versailles. What was Mises' analysis of this treaty? Well, Mises thought that, and again we're jumping ahead here a little bit, but it's in the certainly in the reads. Mises thought that these were unjust treaties. Well, he thought that he didn't think that Austria had been all that much more to blame than anybody else. He thought that it was a victor's peace, et cetera, et cetera. So he criticized the treaties too. And in fact, I mean, Keynes's work on the economic consequences of the peace is, I don't find much fault with it. I mean, the idea is you want these Germans to pay, but then but then we carry out policies that, that mean that they can't pay. So so how does that all work? And so I think that that's, I think Mises would have basically agreed with him. I mean, Mises was looking at a whole culture and a whole world civilization, the whole kind of Germanic world in Austria, Hungary, and Germany, that that was being ripped apart, and that's what he was primarily concerned with in those years. A very, very important part of his whole way of looking at things. In the reading, Mises made an interesting point that the Central Powers wasted valuable time after Brest-Litovsk about trying to get political control of Ukraine rather than relying on trade to provide resources. How much of a difference would there have been in the outcome of the war if the Central Powers had been free traders? Well, it's an excellent question. I can't answer that. I mean, I have no way of knowing that. Certainly, this is a point again. You know, I talked about this last week or a week before. I can't remember, but Mises he was very impressed by the extent to which that the free market had produced all these resources and these structures within all the countries, but in his own country in Germany, to fight the war, and that these resources were then drained away by these governments. But it took a long time to drain them away. That he was amazed by how vital the free market system was. So this is another particular critique of his, that the everybody wanted to invest in governments and in people in Ukraine to make it an independent country, and it's just a waste of time. They should have just traded. I mean, this was a huge point of both Ludendorff's Oberost and of the Austrian Austro-Hungarian general staff to sort of get their teeth into Ukraine and set up a kind of friendly state there by the Yura and these other Ukrainian leaders, who were really not very good leaders. They were viciously nationalist in some measure, and other groups had other problems. So yeah, this was a lot of work for very little return, and they would have done better to have traded with them. Let's see. Was it common at the time of the war to blame the public education system for the war or how it was managed by those who went through the public school system? I've never heard of this before, and so I don't. So there's a quotation here from Lieutenant James Lovegrove, which is below for those who want to read it. Yeah, that would be that critique would be in the minority for people who critique the war. I've heard that one. Philip Sargent asks, why were England and the United States central bankers so chummy after World War I? Well, because they were all the same club. I mean, they were all the Anglo-American elite that Morgan had pushed and that the British Empire had pushed and all these things that we've been talking about. That's why they were so close together. That and the fact that they were both making zillions of dollars on the payment of war loans and reparations and all these other kinds of things. So after the war, they were working more closely than ever. In fact, they were practically just different branches of the same entity. They weren't different people. Think about it. J.P. Morgan was still there, and he lived in New York, but he was in Europe a lot, and his company in New York was J.P. Morgan & Company, and his company in London was Morgan Grenfell. It was the same person, and they would appoint directors here, and they'd crisscross directors, and occasionally they'd want to get a British director to come over. So, I mean, essentially it was a multinational company that that really didn't recognize many boundaries. So that's why, in that case, I mean, they were all just working on the same. They were just like the offense and defense of a team. They just worked together all the time. Okay, let me look at other questions here. I'll try to get back through these questions with texts to read, but I'm not positive I'll be able to do that. I'll give it a shot. I'm glad to entertain all questions, but I just can't answer some of them, and I don't want to have to really go hunting down references and. Spend a lot of time doing that, but I will look at these references and see what I can do. So I guess it's about 9:01, and we've used up our time, and I hope I've answered in some way some of your questions. Some of them I can't, but some of them I can. So I guess we'll call it a night, and I've enjoyed it. Cam announces officially it's coffee time, and my coffee is cold, but I'll raise my cup to him and wish everybody a good night and a good week and a very happy Thanksgiving. I hope everybody has plenty to eat and drink, and that you are with somebody you like, and you have a good break. So until next week, I'll sign off.